It went straight down the middle. Then it started to hook.
Well, you mentioned more than once you used the term pressure. Bruce, we've talked about this with a number of our guests. Tell us a little bit about pressure, particularly in a major setting. How did it manifest itself with Nancy Lopez, and how'd you deal with it?
Well, you know, when I felt like I dealt with pressure in any tournament just by being prepared, for me to really be ready to play in the golf tournament. I think majors were probably tougher because you knew that you had to have the best golf game when you went to majors because the golf courses were going to be tough, especially U.S. Open golf courses, fast greens, undulating, high rough, narrow fairways. And, you know, you had to really prepare for that because that's where you could really get rid of some of the nerves, is knowing that you were really prepared and knew you could hit those shots. Nerves for me were good. I think, you know, when I always teed off, I was nervous. First hole is always nervous. I thought that, you know, because, and I realized that at the end of my career, when I wasn't nervous anymore, that it was time to go home. Because you need to be nervous. And I felt, you know, when I was nervous on the last few holes, like if you're one shot up or one shot behind or even how you handle each situation. And I know when I was nervous on those last few holes, I played better. I didn't make mistakes. And I don't know if nerves were what kept that going, but I just felt really confident and the nerves were good. I mean, I always would take a deep breath. I didn't want anybody to see me doing that, though. I didn't want anybody to think I was nervous. So I always kind of hid the nerves in that respect, because you do, you'll watch players on TV now where they take that big, deep breath like that and you see it. I just never wanted anybody to think or know that I was nervous. So I kind of handled it in a different situation where I kind of held it in. But I did feel nervous, and I truly believe nerves helped me play better. I don't think they were, they helped me not play better, except in one U.S. Open.
So, Nancy, before we get into that fabulous professional career, I look through your 2 years at University of Tulsa. Boy, what a freshman year, All-American, Female Athlete of the Year at Tulsa. Individual women's collegiate champion, on the Curtis Cup team, on the world amateur team. Boy, what a year that was for you.
It was a lot of fun. I think going to Tulsa was a good thing for me. A lot of people were saying you should turn professional after you finish high school. And, you know, I just knew I wasn't ready. I knew playing, I when I was with the LPGA players and watching them by playing in the U.S. Open, or we had a tournament in Hilton Head, I kind of looked and I said to myself, are they really happy? Is that really what I want to do? Do I really want to play professional golf? And I really watched and examined all the players as I watched them warming up. You know, it was fun watching them get free golf balls from the different golf companies. I'm like, wow, they get golf balls, and they got free gloves, and they dressed really nice. And I was like, that looks like a lot of fun, but are they really happy? So I wanted to go to school. I think because I needed to have that time to grow up, because living at home, my mom and dad, I was pretty sheltered. In that, you know, I had a lot of rules from my mom, which is okay because that's how I raised my girls. Had a lot of rules, but I think I needed that freedom to go to school. I knew that if I didn't turn professional, how was I going to make a living? And so those are things I thought about. And then that was during Title IX is when I started college, but it hadn't really come to fruition, I guess I could say, because there was no scholarships for girls back in 1977. And I wanted to go to Arizona State, and they would not give me a scholarship, not even a little bit of a scholarship. So Tulsa University was starting a college or golf school for girls. And they reached out to me And just happened that during that time, I won the Colgate-Palmolive Golf Scholarship. David Foster was a big advocate for women's golf, and I won his scholarship, which was, it was for your need, your golf, and your grades. And so I won that scholarship, which I went to New York to get that scholarship awarded to me. My mom and dad were there, which was a great experience for them. And so I won that scholarship in Tulsa, so they would pay for the other half of that scholarship. So I had a full ride to go to school. And I went to Tulsa too, because I wanted to get an engineering degree, which I didn't know, you know, what field I was going to go into. But I said, you know, that I liked numbers. I was good with numbers. I wasn't like really, really smart. I had to study really hard. And I thought that would be a good way to make a living if I couldn't do it on the golf course.
Yeah.
So I'm on the golf team and loving it, because I think playing team sports was really fun. I mean, I played in the Curtis Cup and the World Cup, which was awesome. And so being able to play on the girls' golf team, and Dale McNamara was our coach. She was awesome too. And Tulsa was great. But after 2 years of going to school and playing on the team and having a great 2 years, the school reached out to me and said, you know, you're going to have to make better grades or you're not going to be able to play on the golf team. And I was making straight C's. I mean, I had calculus and college algebra, college trig. I had computer program. I had all these classes and trying to play on the golf team when we were gone all the time. And I had tutors teaching me all this stuff. And it was really hard. And I after 2 years, I started to think, I said, wow, I either have to quit playing golf and just focus on a career in engineering, or quit school and go on the tour. So I had won a lot of the collegiate events when we were playing. I got a little bored with golf. So I felt like, you know, maybe I need to try to get on the tour. And I made that decision I on my own. My dad, I know, wanted me to turn professional one day, but he never would say it. So I didn't have that pressure. So I called my dad. I said, Dad, I've got to make a decision. I don't know if I can keep up my school, my grades in school. And I think I'm going to try and turn professional. And he was excited. He was happy that I made that decision. And so I went to Ohio, outside of Toledo, to qualify for the LPGA Tour. And back then, to qualify for the LPGA Tour was easy compared to what it is now. it was like a tournament, and you had to have an average score of 78 for 4 days. So I finished second in the U.S. Open at Hazeltine the week before I went to qualifying school. So when I won the money at Hazeltine, I won second place, $7,500. So I was able to keep that money because I was declared professional. So I had money, and it was kind of neat. I know when I got my $7,500 check, I thought I was a millionaire. And I had signed with IMG at that time, and for a few months, I kept that check. And I would pull it out and look at it, you know, in the morning. Man, $7,500 check in my hand. And I remember Mr. McCormick called me, and he was so nice to me. He pretty much sponsored me, because I didn't want my dad to spend any money on my professional career. And he said, just, you know, do whatever you can. You can pay me back. And I started making money pretty quickly, so I never had to pay him back. But anyway, he called and said, you need to send that check because we need to pay your bills. And I didn't want to.
Be a good idea.
Yeah. So I went to qualifying school, and of course, you know, trying to have a 78 average for 4 days seems simple after playing in the U.S. Open. So I tee off, and I think I shot 71 the first day, and then 73 the second day. And I made the cut. Then I went on, and my scores just kept going up because I kept getting more and more nervous. Yeah. But I ended up getting my card. And then you have to take a rules test, which I ended up flunking that. and I had to take it again. But, you know, I was like, they're just – when the rules, when you read them back in those days, they always try to put a tricky word in there so that you would miss it probably if you didn't really think about it. So I had to take the test twice because I didn't know the rules of golf, I guess. And there was some trickery going on, but I ended up getting my tour card and I ended up finishing, if I can remember, it seems like forever. I finished second in my first three LPGA tournaments that I played in, counting that US Open. And I remember going to Europe. I think that was the third one I finished second in. And my mom, not really being a big golfer, I called home and I said, "Mom, I finished second again in the US Open." The tournament in Europe was one. It wasn't a major then. I told her I finished second in that tournament. And she said, "You keep finishing second. When are you going to win?"
Yeah, like, come on, Nancy.
And I said, "Mom, it's not that easy to win. Second and first is a big difference." And so it was just funny. She made me laugh when she asked me when I was going to win. And I was kind of excited that I finished second. So it was a good start. I was able to win money early in my career. So I didn't have a lot of pressure about, you know, winning money week in and week out, because I think that's the biggest thing on tour. When you turn professional and you don't have any money, you've got to win or make decent money to get to the next tournament. Yeah. And I think a lot of players felt that. And fortunately for me, I didn't feel that because I started winning money right off the bat and I was able to kind of relax and not worry about getting to the next tournament. And during those days, I would do outings for $500 on a Monday just to be, you know, was something I told IMG. I said, I want to do outings. If I have to do them every Monday, I'll do that. But I need to make money because I don't want my dad to have to support me at all. So I did outings for Newsweek magazine. And it was amazing because when you don't have any money, $500 was a lot on Mondays. And then
for a day,
And I remember I hit a shot at one of the pro-am days that I did on Monday on a par three, and you got $500 closest to the pin. Well, I ended up winning $500 because I hit it closer than anybody. And I'm like, this is so awesome. I won $500 just hitting one shot closest to the pin. So as my career quickly grew, I started making more money on my daily appearances. But I remember when my agent called me from IMG and he said, "Nancy, you know, you're not going to do those outings for $500 on Monday anymore." I'm like, "Why? Why?"
He said, "Of course, we're going to charge more."
Yeah, he says, "Because now," he says, "I think we can get $25,000 for every appearance you make." I'm like, "Are they nuts? Are they crazy? Yeah. You're going to pay me $25,000 just to play on Monday?" I was like, amazing. This is great.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, I was 19, 20, and it was just an awesome start to a career that, you know, I love golf. I love the LPGA Tour. And I was just as happy as I could be. I mean, it was just a tremendous beginning for me to choose golf and then be able to be successful, at least at the very beginning, for sure.
Yeah. So before we recap your career and then go through some of the early days, because as you said, you came out of the box firing. I do want you to relate a story for our listeners, if you would, because you mentioned to me before that you had a chance to play in the Curtis Cup at Lytham in 1976. And you had sort of a unique experience with the rest of your teammates, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, we were there to play the Curtis Cup, and we were in England, and we got an invitation from Queen Elizabeth to come and have tea with her at Buckingham Palace, which, of course, we were all like, I mean, oh, my God. I mean, first of all, who did she contact?
Yeah.
Let us know that. I mean, I was 17 years old, and when we heard we were going to go meet the Queen at Buckingham Palace, I mean, that was something that you just read about in fairy tale books back when I was little and young and growing up. And so we had to prepare for it. We had to learn how to curtsy. We had to wear our skirts down past our knees. We had to wear white gloves, and you couldn't touch her. That was one where you couldn't touch her. They didn't want us to ask her any questions. And I was telling Mike, I said, "How can you meet the Queen and not ask her any questions?" So as we walk through the gates of Buckingham Palace, and we're walking past the guards. And then we get into this big courtyard. It's just all rocks back behind those walls, just all rocks. We end up walking up a little path and then went into this room that had these huge photos of the queen, the king, you know, the family, which I went through that room when I took my two oldest daughters to England for a trip. I think it was during summer vacation. And I took them, and when we took the tour through Buckingham Palace, we were in that same room, which was amazing. I said, oh my gosh, I was in this room back when I was on the Curtis Cup.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for our listeners, we're talking about the 70-year reign of Queen Elizabeth II, who passed away recently, and she was laid to her final rest yesterday, as a matter of fact. Bruce, you want to recap this sensational LPGA career of Nancy Lopez?
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a two on a par five to win a two-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, one in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcast. Did I tell you about my albatross?
Oh, boy. How much time have we got? Now, what we're going to do is we're going to... Well, here, look at this. 78 Rookie of the Year. Leading money winner, 78, 79, 85. Player of the Year, 78, 79, 85, 88. Vare Trophy, 78, 79, 85. I mean, what a career. Boy, you just jumped right out of the box, didn't you?
And I had three babies.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
throughout all that.
You know, I just loved playing. I loved competing, and I loved the LPGA Tour, and I still love the LPGA Tour, and want to promote it always. It was my other family, being able to travel with the other players and compete week in and week out and have friendships and, you know, meeting people. I met so many wonderful people in my career that are still friends today. You know, my dad, he told me that I was going to win a lot more than I lost, and that wasn't a negative. He just wanted me to go out there and play the best I could, because he said there was somebody that was going to beat me, and it could be every week. And he wanted me to be a good winner and a good loser. So he taught me all those things that I played on the LPGA Tour. And he followed me a lot on the tour. and until at the end where he really couldn't walk much. But he was my motivation on the LPGA tour. My dad was. He always had a hug for me, and I always tell stories about him because he was a character. I remember this is how he was as a father when I was playing amateur golf and then playing professional. But he was always positive, and I know that's why I was successful on the LPGA tour, because I had a great golfing coach, father, best friend, whatever I can call him in all the positive ways. He was just the person that was in my mind all the time when I was out there playing golf. And I remember playing in the U.S. Open in Philadelphia, and I was an amateur, and it was a tough golf course, and it kicked my butt for 2 days. And I really practiced hard and really thought I was going to play well there, but didn't suit my eye, never felt comfortable there. And after 2 days, I was 12 over par, knew I was going to miss the cut. And I walked off the green sobbing a little bit. And my dad looked at me and he hugged me and he said, "Nancy, it's okay. I didn't want to see you at 25 over par anyway." and I went from crying to laughing, because if it was okay with my dad, then everything was good.
Everything was fine.
Yeah. So, you know, playing on the LPGA tour and being able to, I only hold on to one record right now, and that's Rookie of the Year, Player of the Year, and Vare Trophy winner. And
first year out too.
Yeah. And I, that's one that, you know, I would love to keep it. And so whenever there's a player that's a rookie and she can win Rookie of the Year, Player of the Year, I just hope she doesn't win the Vare Trophy. I don't wish bad on her, but yeah. I just want to hold on to that one if I can. Yeah. But, you know, playing on the LPGA Tour, being so young, it was really, really so much fun. You know, it was like, okay, I'm played good today and the press wants to hear what I have to say. I mean, when you're young like that, it's just so new and so, like I said, so much fun. And, you know, then competing and then feeling the pressure of being on the LPGA Tour and kind of carrying the torch for them for a little while. That was the tough part of it. Because every sponsor wanted you to come and play in their tournament. And back then, I think we had about 41 tournaments, and you just can't play.
Couldn't do it all.
Tournaments. Yeah. So, pressure from the commissioner, you know, coming to my home and asking me to please play in tournaments. And it was really, really tough during that time. But, you know, I knew that what my role was as an LPGA player. And I never felt like I did things for Nancy Lopez. I did it because my tour needed me. And through that, it helped me to become who I was on the LPGA tour, with the press and with the fans and with the sponsors. But there were days I was kicking dirt all the way to maybe a press conference that I didn't want to do. Or, you know, when we won, I won 9 tournaments my rookie year. You have to go back the next year and do all the press conferences to prepare for that tournament. So winning 9, I had to do 9 trips to 9 different states.
Press days, yeah. You did something else too that first year, didn't you? You won 5 tournaments in a row.
Yes, I did. I won 5.
Tell us about that.
Well, I can't tell you which ones they were out of my memory banks, but I can tell you the 5th one I won in a row, and that was in Rochester, New York. And the way it happened too, Bruce, I won 4. I took off a week and then won the 5th. So I won the 5 in a row that I played in.
Right.
So I go to Rochester, and Rochester is kind of like my hometown now. People fell in love with me, and I fell in love with them. They wanted to see me win 5 in a row because the press was covering it. I mean, they even put my name on some of the leaderboards at PGA events because I was winning so much. I think they put my name on the board at Cherry Hill when they were playing there. I think they put me in like 3rd place. They had Lopez up there, which is
that's funny.
So I'm playing in Rochester, And there was, I felt pressure, but I was playing good with that pressure. And I knew, well, what happened that week too, I think it was on Friday, I was hitting this hook. And there were a lot of people. I mean, the fairways were lined with people because they wanted to see if I could win five in a row. I'm hitting this terrible hook, and my dad always said, if you're hitting it poorly, either, you know, pull a three wood out or do something different, just get rid of that negative. So play it. So I start playing this hook. So I'm aiming right over those people. So it hook. And on the 10th hole on Friday, it didn't hook. I get to my drive, and I used to hit a rocket. When my ball came off my club, it was hot. And it was going into the crowd, and I know it's going to hurt somebody. And I can't even get the word four out. I'm trying to yell four. My caddy's yelling four. And it's like three or four deep of people. And that ball hits in the crowd, and it hits, and it goes up into the air. And my caddy's yelling for it not to go out of bounds. And I'm saying, out of bounds? I've just killed somebody. I don't care if it's out of bounds. So we get up there to my ball, and I'm shaking. I mean, I am upset because I know I've hurt somebody. I get up to where the crowd's surrounding this gentleman, and he's laying there on the ground. There's blood everywhere, and his hand is holding his head, and I'm crying. I'm like, are you okay? Because I stop and think, what if I would have killed him? What would have happened in my whole career? Would I have quit playing golf? I was so shook up from that. It was horrifying. And I'm pretty much hovering over him, and he's looking up at me bleeding. And I said, are you okay? And he's smiling. He says, I'm fine. I'm like, oh my God. So we walk away, you know, he's fine. They're coming to help him, and we're walking on, and I'm crying. I ended up double bogeying that hole. I was so upset. And as I tee off on 11, I'm trying to get back focused on what's going on. And I looked at Roscoe, my caddy, who I fired 9 times. He worked for me 13 years. I fired him 9 times.
Roscoe but Jones.
I loved him. And then I could just kill him. So we're walking down 11, and I decided to make this a positive. I said, Roscoe, I said, if we win this tournament, we're going to dedicate it to that guy I almost killed. And so I, as the days go on, that's my goal. So now I'm trying to win my fifth in a row after I've almost killed somebody. And I know that backside always was, it was a tough side for me. And I knew that I had to play well on Sunday. And I was in the final group on Sunday. And I knew I had to play well on the backside. And Jane Blaylock was who was leading the tournament at that time. And so I shot even par, I believe, on the front side. Now the true test was going on that backside and playing it well. Well, I ended up winning, and I won my fifth in a row. And it was an accomplishment for me, because there was so much buildup, and there was a lot of pressure on the outside, but it was like, I can do this. I wanted to. It was a goal I wanted to do. And when you're playing good like that, the fairways get wider, the greens get bigger, the holes get bigger, and you just feel like you can hit every shot great. And that's pretty much what happened in that fifth in a row. And then I did dedicate the tournament to, his name was Jerry Messalella. He was a dentist. He's still alive because I went back to Rochester this year for a charity celebration. They wanted to do a celebration of my life, my golf there in Rochester, which was really, really special.
That's nice.
They surprised me with Jerry Messalella. He came to the luncheon, and he became a friend. I mean, I invited him to my wedding, and he came to my wedding, and he became a friend. So there are a lot of great memories there in Rochester, New York for me. And I think one of my favorite things too was I love their white hots, and they were so good, because after I finished playing, I'd always go have a white hot with all my friends. And after I won, that's how we celebrated.
So I think the progression was you win in Baltimore, and then you win the Coke Classic, and then the Golden Lights Championship, You won what would have been your first major, which we'll talk about, the LPGA Championship, and then boom, Bankers Trust Classic, and off you go. Five straight wins, nine in your first year. So I want you to paint two pictures for us. The first one I want to talk about is, you know, you're 20, 21 years old. You're just coming out on tour. Everything's new to you, right? I mean, that first trip around the sun, you don't know any hotels. You don't know the golf courses. You barely know who you're playing with. Paint that picture for our listeners of what that was like back during that time frame.
You know, when I started on the tour, and like you said, you didn't know where to stay. You kind of asked some of the players. They always gave you a fact sheet. Of course, you stayed where, you know, you could afford to. Most of the place we stayed were motels. So you're pretty much, you know, you park outside. My mom and dad always taught me to be safe. So, you know, always before I got out of my car, I'd look around, make sure there was nobody there to hurt me. And you still thought about those things back way back then. There was one experience for me. We were in, I don't know if it was Baltimore, but, being young the way that I was, I mean, I stayed by myself. We were playing in a golf tournament, and whenever I watch movies or anything, I always kind of related it to my life. So I'm playing in this tournament, and there's this cute blonde guy following me. And I was like, that guy's really cute, but could he be weird? And so he was following me on Tuesday and he followed me on Wednesday, and I kind of found out who he was. He was a member there at the club and he had good parents, and he kept following me. Well, he ended up asking me out on a date, and I went on the date. I went on the date with him on Friday and really liked him. He was so cute. And so that Saturday night, before that happened, there was a gentleman that knocked on my door. And back then, there was not a peephole on my door. So I opened it. And here I was, this little 20-year-old, you know, naive and stupid, opened the door, and there's this guy standing there. And this is not the blonde guy. This is some other guy. He's standing there at my door, and I'm like, hello? And I didn't think anything of it. He goes, hi, Nancy. And then I got nervous. I'm saying, hi, Nancy. I thought he was just somebody looking for something in that hotel or motel. And he said, I saw you at the golf course and you have such a great smile. And I was like, oh, my gosh. Who is this guy? He said, would you like to go to dinner? I said, I have plans. I didn't have plans, but I said I had plans. So I said, thank you very much. But, you know, so I closed the door. I was like, oh my gosh, that guy followed me to the motel. Well, I'm in my room for another few hours. Somebody knocks on the door. I didn't think anything of it. I opened it again. And there's that same guy.
I'm like,
what am I thinking? He's got flowers in his hand. And I'm like, where did you get those flowers? He goes, oh, I picked them out of somebody's yard. It was so weird. So I said, how did you find out what my room was? He goes, well, I went to the front desk and the guy, and this is really weird. I mean, he says the guy went behind to go do something. And so I went around the desk to find out what your room number was. And I said, you know, I really have to go get ready for dinner with my other friends. So I close the door and I am like, this is so horrible. So I think that happened on Thursday night, because my caddy Roscoe that I fired nine times, I told him he had to start following me back to my hotel, make sure no guys follow me back to my hotel. And he would sit outside my room and make sure nobody followed me back. That's how it was at that time. So anyway, I ended up going, you know, this other little affair of mine with this blonde guy that I wanted to be able to go on a date with. I went out with him on Friday. So Saturday night, back in those days when people would call rooms, they pretty much, you know, plugged it in, I think. And then if they didn't plug it, the phone kept ringing. So I'm in my room and I hear this phone ringing in the room next door to me about midnight. And I'm like, oh my gosh, why didn't somebody answer that phone? Rings and rings and rings. So now I'm starting to think, oh my gosh, that guy has come back and he's killed the guy at the front desk. killed him. Oh my gosh. Now I'm getting really scared because, you know, I'm talking about movies. Movies kind of send you that way. I call the front desk and nobody answers. I said, oh my gosh.
So I call dead.
He's dead. I call the police. And the police didn't know who Nancy Lopez was.
No.
And I just pretty much started my career. And I said, this is Nancy Lopez. I'm on the LPG tour. And I think the guy at the front desk is dead. Because no, he does not answer the phone. And the phone is ringing next door to me. And nobody's answering it. And I kind of told him about what was going on with this guy that followed me. So the police come. And somebody knocks at my door. And, of course, I am not going to answer the door this time. I said, hello, who is that? And he says, it's Officer so-and-so and Miss Lopez. There's nobody dead at the front desk.
He'd already checked for you.
I'm like, okay, great. But what happened? He says, well, he connected the call and he fell asleep. And I'm like, oh my gosh. I was just so, I mean, it was crazy.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
Whack down the fairway. It went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.